House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:20 p.m. On April 7th. Present, we have Representative Herron, Representative Reinbold, Representative Josephson, Representative Sadler, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Three items on the calendar today, House Bill 254, House Bill 357, and House Bill 336. First up is House Bill 357, Powers of Attorney. Kim, are you presenting? Or Dan? Representative Sadler is going to present along with his staff, Kim Skipper.
Mr. Chairman?
Any questions for the sponsor?
If we could just reboot.
Oh, sure. Brief please.
We're back on the record now,
and the first item on the calendar is House Bill 357, but under the correct name, it is House Bill 357, Access to Licensed Premises. So, right bill number, and presenting the bill is Representative Dan Sadler and his staff, Kim Skipper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12. I appreciate you hearing House Bill 357 this afternoon. First, I want to make sure you understand what this bill is not. HB 357 does not allow anyone under 21 to drink alcohol legally. The bill title can be a little bit diverting. Instead, it is really considered an access bill with two basic elements. Section 1 of the bill relates to servicemen and women who are over 21. This bill makes it easier for them and their spouses to enjoy companionship in the clubhouses of service and patriotic organizations. I'm going to call them patriotic clubs like the American Legion Hall or the Veterans of Foreign Wars posts, are great institutions where veterans and active duty soldiers can relax with their buddies and spouses, their places to enjoy the special understanding and support from others who have been there, seen the elephant, and understand the rigors of military life. The legislature does recognize these values, and since 2006, active duty personnel who are over 21 can enter such clubs using their military ID cards. However, on page 1 of the bill, line 10, you'll see language that says, state law still limits such access to special occasions only. HB 357 removes that limitation. Previous version of the bill, one legislature ago, had added and their accompanying spouses, and that's underlined here too, but don't worry, spouses can't drink unless they're over 21 as well. The second element of this bill, section 2, relates to soldiers who are under the age of 21. This bill allows them to enter licensed premises of patriotic clubs if they're members or if they're the guests of a member. Again, it does not allow them to drink alcohol. Military commanders, small unit leaders, will sometimes use these clubs to hold off-base commanders' calls to welcome soldiers home, to give them a send-off, or to share important information with them, and excluding the younger soldiers can erode unit cohesion and can diminish morale by dividing up the unit by the old guys and the young guys. So again, this bill lets under 21 soldiers enter such clubs if they are members or guests of members. And section 3 of the bill is just conforming language allowing them to, regarding the allowance for club admission granted in section 2. I emphasize again that this bill does not permit underage soldiers to drink alcohol. It simply clarifies that soldiers who are over 21 or their spouses don't have to wait for a special occasion to visit patriotic clubs. And it clarifies that soldiers under 21 can visit if they are club members or guests. And your support for this bill would demonstrate that Alaska understands and wants to accommodate the special needs of the young men and women in uniform who defend our freedom.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Speaker Chenault.
And, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to address them.
I was going to have you walk me through the fiscal note, but I don't think that'll be necessary.
Okay. That's absolutely correct.
Zero fiscal note.
It'd be a short fit, though.
Any questions for the bill sponsor? Well, then, Representative Reinbold.
Okay, just a quick question. I thought this was, it is for the spouse, to allow the spouse in, but it's also for someone under 21 to visit.
Excuse me. Yes, they cannot drink, but they are allowed to visit if they are members or guests of a member. There might be a situation where a person who is an underage person could be a member, and they could be still under 21. And again, this, I hope I addressed the question. I'm going to confuse myself.
Follow up?
Yeah, I guess it's I'm trying to calculate how much different it is from just going into a regular, you know, restaurant or bar that serves alcohol. 18-year-olds,
there
I don't know. Go ahead.
To the Chair, Representative Reinbold, there are provisions in Alaska's law regarding access to licensed premise that do allow people who are under 21 to enter if they are accompanied by an adult, but again, it does not allow them to drink.
And I might add, in a few minutes, we'll get to some of the testimony. We do have Shirley Cote from the ABC signed up, so it'll, in a few minutes we can bring her into the dialogue. Representative Josephson.
This sounds like a good bill, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any problem with it. There are some fraternization rules that are sort of unique to the military about officers and enlisted socializing, but I assume that doesn't impact this one way or the other. But they can coexist with this.
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, this bill does not address fraternization.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, is there anybody in the room that would care to testify this on this bill? Public testimony is open. Seeing none, is there anybody online? Seeing none, I will close out public testimony. And we do have Shirley Cote from the ABC on questions for the board members. Well, thank you, Shirley. I think you scared everybody.
Does she have any issues?
No. No, she's questions only. Do you want to add anything, though, Shirley?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, there was a little bit of delay there, so I wasn't sure if you were calling upon me or not. But thank you very, very much for the recognition. I am available for questions only. I don't really have a statement either for or against this bill.
Representative Reinbold.
So do you see, you don't see any concerns? Is that what I'm hearing you say? Or do you have any issues that you're comfortable that have been addressed?
That's a good question. I think that Representative Sadler addressed the issue that these underage persons would not be allowed to drink on the premises. And certainly that would be a concern.
Okay, so in line 16 it says that the person is under 16 is accompanied by a person over the age of 21. The parent or guardian of the underage person consents. The premises are designed by the board as a restaurant for purposes of this section, and the person enters remains in for dining only. I mean, are you good with that?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, and then there's an added section that the person is permitted on the premises under 04-11-110-G, which is that is the club license. So it would be treated, although it's not a restaurant eating place license, with a restaurant designation permit, the club would be treated in a similar fashion to a restaurant eating place license.
I guess what my question is, how in the world are you going to know if the parent, are they going to have a permission slip?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, we deal with that issue, a little bit. We deal with it more than what we do. If we get complaints about it, it seems that the restaurant is allowing persons under the age of 16, we would get a call and we would look into it. But if the parents or guardian consent, you know, we have situations like in a Pizza Hut where a coach from a high school sports team takes some kids in. Of course, that's with the parent or guardian's consent. But in terms of getting, you know, a written letter by the parents, that's kind of up to the school and the restaurant eating place licensee to ensure that that is in compliance with the law.
Okay, can I ask?
The other thing is there's a liquor license hanging out there that ultimately could is the heavy hammer.
Sure.
On violations. Representative Sadler.
It might address Representative Reinbold's questions. That actually is existing statute, and this bill does not deal with the age 16 or under. The only thing that changes is the bottom.
Okay. I guess I'll ask him if you don't mind. Rep. Sadler?
Sure.
Representative Sadler. Okay, so I guess what I'm just putting myself in a scenario like the VFW. I'm not sure how comfortable all these people that are in the VFW, if they would want it to turn into a family, you know, type Denny's or whatever, you know, type restaurant. I guess that's where I don't see any letters of support. I don't know if my staff didn't print them off or if there isn't any. It's just I don't know if there's controversy on either side of the aisle. I just don't know.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold. Yes, there is actually letters and testimony in the back of the package from a gentleman who is a former command. State commander of the VFW and a gentleman who is the commander of post 10029. And the VFWs actually are used as family organizations or family meeting places. I know in 9785 post Needle River, they have a downstairs which is frequently rented out for public events, family events, children are there, and there's an upstairs licensed premise as well. And again, the point, this legislation before us does not deal with the children of age 16 or under accessing licensed premises.
You can talk to them. Yeah. Okay. Yes. And I'm very familiar with the renting out the facilities. I mean, I've been to many, many events, you know, below, but no, I'm not a member upstairs. So I always have to be a guest. I have to be invited. I have to be escorted. Mm-hmm. And so that I just want to make sure that, you know, the people who frequent that are comfortable with this. And it sounds like you do have letters of support. And that's exactly what I was looking for.
If I could add this, having been back through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I was back in town for the Vietnam Veterans Welcome Home Day ceremony. And John Yuzik, Bill Yudzikas. Yudzikas. I always mispronounce his name. He asked me what was up with this bill and why not push it this year. So there is interest and support for it from our hometown.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sadler, would this also include the Elks Club or the Moose Club? Or does it have to be strictly military sort of affiliation?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, that's a good question. My understanding is this is the Patriotic Club license and is distinct from the fraternal organizations, but I would actually take advantage of having the lifeline to Shirley Cote to ask that question.
Shirley, you want to take that question?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson, the club license authorizes a club or organization, and the club is a fraternal organization, patriotic organization, or social organization that's been chartered by a state or national organization for a period of two consecutive years before application of a license under this section, and then or chartered by a national organization, and the national organization has maintained a chartered club or organization within the state for a period of at least 20 years. So if a club fits either one of those criteria, they can have a club license.
So, Paul? It sounds like the answer is yes, then. Right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Jefferson, the question that you had, I guess I need to answer the question again. Sorry about that.
Sure. Through the chair, Ms. Cote, is it your understanding that the Elks and Moose Clubs would also fall under this rubric?
I'm through the chair. Yes, Representative Jefferson, the answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 357 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee and we'll take a break at ease. We're back on the record now. Second item on the calendar today is House Bill 254.
I always have to
powers of attorney. With this to present the bill, and sponsor Representative Hughes, who I think is on her way, and Ginger Blaisdell. The sponsor has brought forward a blank CS in the members' packet. I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute House Bill 254 version /U as the working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. Ginger, walk us through.
All right. Thank you. And yes, Representative Hughes is on her way. For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm staff to Representative Hughes. And I'll let her do the intro, but what I can do to explain the CS that was just adopted. The reason you have a CS before you rather than the original version is you can see it's a rather lengthy and kind of a technical, not terribly exciting bill. But I received it the day before the pre-file deadline, so we decided to go ahead and file it and make the technical corrections after the fact. And what you have before you is the one that has those corrections made. Most of them were where a word was missed being deleted or a word needed to be added, kind of a correction. She's not here yet. So the power of attorney bill does primarily four things. On page 2, it starts by changing the instructions of the form power of attorney so that the principal, who is the person who has the assets, is more likely to consider each kind of financial power that he or she is awarding to the agent, who is the person who will be acting on their behalf. On page 27, there is language to improve the ability for an agent to be removed of his or her powers if, in the event, there's dishonesty, a breach of the agreement, if they're generally not acting on the best interest of the principal. And page 28 adds a new section that describes the agent's duties. And we hadn't really had a description of their duties in statute before, so this really clarifies for someone who decides they want to be a power of attorney what they're in for. Page 32 adds a section outlining criteria for accepting a power of attorney. And page 34 outlines what steps are taken when a power of attorney is terminated or if the agent resigns. And again, that had never been clearly defined. The other thing you'll see throughout this bill are a number of just individual words that are changed or replaced. We changed the word disability with the word incapacity because there are a number of circumstances where someone may not be capable to make financial transactions by themselves. They might be out of country. They could be missing. They could be injured for a certain period of time, but they will improve health-wise. And so incapacity was a more appropriate term rather than disability. And then on page 36, we do define the word or the term incapacity. So those are the four main changes to a 30-plus page bill.
Well, part of the problem is we didn't have the first bill, so if you could walk us through the sectional, between the sectional and the changes, I think we should have a pretty good grasp on it.
Sure. So I'm referring to bill version U, which is the CS that was just adopted. Section 1 replaces the current definition of an agent. Before we had terms like attorney in fact, we had a couple other terms that kind of meant you were the agent, but we've defined what an agent is and replaced all of the terms with the word agent. Section 2 is a technical change where anywhere a statute's being changed, we're adding the United States Virgin Islands as a definition of state. Section 3 is new definitions for durable, like a durable attorney, electronic, power of attorney, principal, record, and sign. And what I'll highlight real quick, the word sign means to present an intent to authenticate or adopt a record. And one question that was brought to me by a senior center was some individuals who might be severely arthritic can hardly sign their name once on the bottom of the form. And they wanted to make sure it was not a burden for them to have to initial all of the yes, no boxes.
Excuse me for 1 minute. I'd like to acknowledge we've been joined by the sponsor representing Venus. Please join us at the table.
All right.
We're going through the sectional now.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Heron has rejoined us.
We just started the sectional. Do you want me to continue, or do you want to get kind of the introduction from Representative Hughes?
Well, let's finish the sectional, and then we'll...
Okay.
Certainly.
I won't have many. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Blaisdell, this new definition for durable, will that apply to things like living wills? Because I know that term comes up in other statutes. I'm confident it does.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it only applies to this particular act.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Well, I was pulling my mic close, but I was actually going to make a comment later. But I really like what you guys did to page 3 and 4 and how they're all broken down into real estate and insurance and estate and J, civil or military service, you know, retirement. I really like that part of the bill.
Representative Schnall.
Mr. Chairman, the last... I don't have it in front of me, but the last power of attorney I was part of was very similar to this. But I had a question, and you probably don't know the answer, but Representative Josephson might, Mr. Chairman. Why is a power of attorney not good in a small claims case? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't
Representative Josephson, you have an answer for that?
Well, the first thing I would do is look at that. There's separate rules for small claims, and small claims are part of district court, so I would look at those civil rules, but I don't know the answer right of hand.
Me either.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess we're on section 4.
Yes. Actually, if you don't mind, the definition of sign. Also, in that definition, you'll see that it also allows an individual to adopt any of those signature spots if you need to have electronic sound, a certain symbol like an X or a check mark, or just following a particular process. So someone can help them fill this out, and we wanted to make sure that that was understood. All right. Section 4 changes the statutory form from a form that was, if you sign the bottom of the form, you give every single power to that individual. And by changing it to a yes, no, opt out on each of those choices, the intent is that whoever is helping the incapacitated person complete the form would hopefully help them make a better educated choice. And so they would at least be informed of what they're signing over, even if it's just two or three words, not the whole description. That was probably the most significant change that the long-term care ombudsman and some of the senior centers expressed to me, is to make sure that one signature doesn't give away the whole farm.
Representative Reinbold.
I'm just so excited about this because we have to deal with a power of attorney in my own life, and this is so incredibly helpful because there are certain things that we want certain people to be taken care of, and, mm-hmm. and this opt-in, I tell you, this really is just going to be a fantastic change to current law. I just want to say thank you.
Great. Thank you. Section 5 is amending statutes that remove the powers to revoke, create, or modify a trust as just a general authority. And you'll see throughout this whole bill, there are a whole lot of sections that remove, revoke, create, or amend a trust throughout. And what you'll see on page 4, there's a grant of specific authority. And so we want the principal to be fully aware when they grant these three items, because they do tend to be a little bit more impactful. The first one is the trust. So any change they might make to a trust would have to have specific authority granted. Making a gift, it'd be nice to gift anything, I guess. And then the third one is create or change a beneficiary designation. And so those three are very specific, and they might be overarching over some of these other powers. And so those have to be specifically granted.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay, on line 20, page 4, it says create, amend, revoke, or terminate an inter vivos trust. Is that a living trust?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, it is. So an inter vivos trust is used in estate planning created during the lifetime of the trustor, also known as a living trust. And so, and the rest of it, basically living trust. Section 6, Section 7, again, removing those words as a general provision, and because now you have to specifically identify a trust. Section 8 allows the agent to use credit and debit cards. The last time this bill was significantly, or the powers of attorney were significantly changed, was 1988. We were just looking it up a few hours ago. And in 1988, probably everyone didn't have automatic transfer and debit card and electronic payment. So this brings us into the 21st century. Section 9 amends existing statute to conduct additional business actions in the event the power of attorney includes running their business. Section 10 allows them to exercise investment powers, again, that had not been included previously. Section 11 is, let me look at that one real quick. Which page is that? 16. Section 11 is on page 16. Oh, this is business. That's the business transactions. Okay, and that has to do with the gift regulations, too, that are specific authorities now. Section 12 is insurance transactions. Again, I think I may have gotten a couple of these off again. So insurance transactions, so it's allowing the power of attorney to make decisions on insurance payments. Personal relationships, you'll see quite a few items on personal relationships, and that starts on page 22. And the few changes there, a lot of these are recommendations from court cases and the kinds of personal relationship issues that have come up. So you might see things like child support payments, and if the principal normally provided a particular living standard for someone, that the agent would also provide that same living standard for that person. Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Schnault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You brought that up that you would give, the agent would, I guess, exercise the authority to allow a person to live basically in the customary support, and has indicated the intent to support them. Are you taking authority away from a power of attorney, or are you expanding it there? Because I would think that you have the power of attorney for somebody, whether it's me or whoever, and you didn't feel that the investments were right, or you didn't feel that they should be getting the money there. They thought they should. Does this not take power away from someone who has the power of attorney to control the purse string, so to speak?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault.
I don't know if I got it out right or not. But
yeah, I think I know where you're coming. I guess there's two ways to look at it. The first one is if indeed this was selected from the principal to that power of attorney, if they were going to let them have this particular action as part of their powers. So they could control it that way and say, I only want you to balance my checkbook, the rest of things I'm making the decision for. So they may not choose that. When I looked at the existing law, it does say that for a power of attorney, like in number one, do all acts necessary to maintain customary standard of living of the spouse, children, other dependents. Mm-hmm. And what we did is add additional language that just says, and if there's a child that's later born. So it could be maybe a parent who had a difficult childbirth and had to sign something away, but that the baby that then comes along would also be given a standard of living. Whether that gives more authority or less, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it could be circumstantial to the person making those choices. All right. Yeah. The other change at the bottom of page 24, this is also dealing with the power of attorney over personal relationships. It does say that there could be instances where they would be privy to HIPAA protected information, and that would be in the event that they have been asked to take care of the health care on behalf of the principal. So you may see some health care items come through. Section 15 on page 25 is giving the power of attorney authority over civil or military service and the benefits that they might receive for them. And some of that was brought out a lot because of the military actions the United States has been involved in. We have people who are overseas, and maybe they don't come back in the same capacity when they left. And so even shipping household effects, things like that, it became fairly apparent more language was needed. Section 16 on page 26 is a new subsection, and this one is with respect to retirement plans. And that was a new section that had never been considered before in the power of attorney, so we did add that. And then that pretty much takes care of all of the descriptions of what's in the form. And these are further definitions of those little check-off yes-no boxes. And so now we move into the rest of how the power of attorney bill works. Section 17 says that if a power of attorney was executed in another state, that the state of Alaska would recognize that as being valid as long as it was completed under the rules of the other jurisdiction. Section 18, I think this is a great section, and this is one that the long-term care ombudsman was really excited to see. So starting on line 16, it talks about the ability to relieve a power of attorney of their ability or their not being an agent anymore if they are acting dishonest, improper motive, reckless. You know, so basically if they're not managing it in an appropriate manner, they can be removed. And before, there really wasn't a way that you could remove someone once they had received a power of attorney.
Were these section numbers off the original policy? Yeah, number 10 didn't match up with insurance, and a couple of them matched
in my section analysis?
Yeah.
I think I blew it yet again. That's why I started just walking you through the bill. It made more sense. I probably started with the original one, and the corrected versions didn't match up quite the same way. So I apologize for that. But Section 18, that was one piece that the long-term care ombudsman was very happy about, being able to relieve someone who was not acting appropriately. Section 19, acting on their behalf. Section 19 includes all of the agent's duties. So when you get to page 28, it starts talking about acting in good faith, acting on their behalf, acting only within the scope of the authority granted to you. So it really identifies the duties of an agent, which is great. And it does identify if you have a breach of agreement as a power of attorney, it identifies all of those provisions. Section 20 is, all of the language is already in the statute, and it's basically correcting the words principal, incapacity, and agent throughout. So that one is, and also suspend, revoke, and terminate the power of attorney. Again, just clean up language. Most of it is all technical at this point in relation to other laws, so that part is good. The definition of incapacity is one thing I think was important. So instead of it being a person who is disabled, how it used to read, someone who could be missing, could be outside of the United States, unable to manage their, unable to return, detained in a penal system, a number of things there. If you accept the power of attorney, it also says that you can have someone translate for you in a court of law, make sure they understand that it's valid and what they're getting into. Termination of a power of attorney, there's a number of ways you can terminate one, or an agent can resign. Some more technical word changes, and then adding the last few definitions starting on the bottom of page 35. So in a really fast rundown of a 37-page bill, again, what we've done is basically four primary things. We fixed the form to make it a little bit more responsible, I think, for the person giving away their powers. It improves the language to let a power of attorney be removed from their duties if they're not acting appropriately. Identifies what your duties are as a power of attorney, and changes some definitions.
Representative Jones?
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Blaisdell, when I practiced family law and a Title 13 thing came up, I often tried to get co-counsel because I was terrified of this title. But there are frequent uses of the term conservatorship and trustees. How does this interplay with those terms? Do you know, particularly conservatorship, where someone has lots of these same powers, but they're not called a power of attorney. They're called conservatorships or something like that. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Through the chairman, I'm not sure of that specific difference.
Okay.
I know all of the definitions we worked on here were specific to a power of attorney,
okay. And
so I didn't look at all the other options.
Well,
thank you. And who's who guided you through this process? I'm just curious. Who was it? A model, or was it who sort of proposed the concept?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the first request to have this changed was from a representative of AARP.
Mm-hmm. Actually, could I respond to that?
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm.
Actually, the first...
Read your name on
yes,
the record, please.
I will do that, and thank you. I'm Shelley Hughes, representative from Palmer, and thank you to the committee, and I am sorry I wasn't here. The order of the bills got quickly changed, so I was scrambling. And I was first approached by friends that I enjoy at the senior center, that there had been problems, and then I discussed it with, at that time, some of you may remember Pat Luby, who was up here for a number of years, and he directed us that there were was work being done. So the Uniform Code Commission has, of course, is working across the states, and I had a lot of hesitation with that because we don't necessarily want to do everything like other states, but we did want to look at it to see what might make sense for Alaska, so we did work through that. And I might mention, too, we've been working with AARP's new counterpart, the Association of Mature Americans, I believe it might be called, and they've been supportive, too, and they're going to be providing a letter to us. But so we did pick and choose. So it came to our attention, so we went through that, and then we had a lot of input from the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, from the Office of the Governor as well, and there's a pretty comprehensive statement and information from her with specific recommendations. So it was definitely a joint effort, and Ginger's done a good job. It's a lot of information, and it was a lot of, there's been work done over the years on this section of law, but the real substantial work was last done in 1988, and a little bit's been done along the way. But I think it was time, when I think that 1 in 7 Alaskans is age 60 and over, and I'm thankful I'm not there yet. It is something that we need to look out for vulnerable Alaskans, and I believe that it is, it's helpful to the vulnerable Alaskan, but also to which I think of right now at my age of my parents. But it's also going to be helpful to those of us who are helping take care of our parents, because it really clarifies things. So it really is important on both ends. And I'll mention the interstate capability. There you go. Or compatibility. Which is it? Through the chair, Mr. Sadler probably could tell me which word is the best there. But I think that in our very mobile world is getting more important, because if we are separated by state lines, it can be problematic. And that was why we did take it upon ourselves to go through the Uniform Law Commission's recommendation to see what made sense for Alaska, because some of us in this room may be separated from our parents by a state line. So I think that was an important thing, too, in this day and age. So.
Representative Reinbold.
I'm still so intrigued by, the great changes that you made to this bill. But on page line 31, it's talking about estate transactions, and I'm sure you can answer this. Page 3, line 31. Estate transactions. So, and I'm sure you can answer this question. It's not a complicated question, but let's say you have asked someone else to do your will, but then you give someone the ability to deal with your estate transactions. Then I see a few pages later where it says, page 4, line 26 and 28, there's different agents, and you can do it together or you can do it separately. I guess my question is there a person, like let's say your son is supposed to be doing your will, you've designated him to do your will, and but your spouse may still be alive, but you've designated that power away to your son. Which one would have jurisdiction, the one you gave power of authority to or the one you requested to do your will? And it, just because I saw a real estate transaction, it spurred that question on.
Mm-hmm. Can we answer it?
Yeah, go for it.
So, through the chair, this is Ginger Blaisdell. So, Representative Reinbold, on item G, which is estate transactions that you had referenced, if you look at section 13 on page 21, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was estate transactions. It further identifies everything that you get to do as a power of attorney for an estate transaction. Once you enter into a will situation, my understanding from Ledge Legal is that a will is once someone dies, and the power of attorney is while they're still living. And so it might flip completely, where a will might be handled differently than your power of attorney, which is your day-to-day actions. I don't know if that answers you well enough.
I think she's right. Totally right.
Okay, because I was thinking that could be a heyday for lawyers, but okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Recommendation? No, number one, I like the bill. I think probably everybody here likes the bill. But you have one more committee, and I suggest you use the time to get the sectional to match up with the
I think
the
I
policy.
Can remember better than I did this time, yes.
Because the next committee has Max on it, but then again, Max, or Representative Gruenberg is also a co-prime on the policy, so.
Correct.
He might cut you a little bit of slack, but I think there are other committee members that might not. But
yes.
At this point, any time or any questions for the sponsor before we open it up? Anybody in the room? With that, we'll open up public testimony. Anybody in the room? Seeing none, and I think we have Ken Hellander, AARP. Are you with us?
Hey.
Please say your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chairman Olson. My name is Ken Hellander.
I represent the interests of AARP Alaska and the 90,000 members. So I'm basically talking from a consumer point of view. We have been involved with Representative Hughes and Ginger for some time. My predecessor, Pat Luby, we believe that this is a very important bill that protects the interests of older Alaskans. A power of attorney is a legal document used by an individual that we call the principal to name someone else or the agent to make financial decisions and act on the principal's behalf. And I want to state here just categorically that this is not a healthcare power of attorney. It doesn't authorize healthcare decisions. It authorizes payment for healthcare, but not healthcare decisions. A power of attorney can be used to plan for the possibility of future incapacity and to avoid the court appointment of a guardian or conservator, which I think goes to Representative Josephson's question about conservatorship, which is a court appointment. You know, a power of attorney is private. There is no oversight by a court. State laws are often unclear about the duty owed by the agent to the principal. This combination of broad authority, lack of oversight, and unclear duties makes it possible for agents to misuse their authority. Power of attorney abuse, often called a license to steal, is a form of financial exploitation. To help curb this type of elder financial exploitation, AARP supports state efforts to expand the POA laws by adopting reforms that are at least as stringent as those outlined in the Uniform Power of Attorney Act. The Uniform Power of Attorney Act contains provisions that aim to promote autonomy and to prevent, detect, and redress power of attorney abuse. The most important of these provisions pertain to the so-called hot powers. Under the current statute, the principal gives blanket consent to these powers with a signature unless they intentionally cross them off the list. This bill, following the Uniform Power of Attorney format, requires the principal to opt in by initialing each specific power. This action requires more careful consideration and awareness on the part of the principal as to duties they are delegating to the agent, and it lessens the opportunity for exploitation. In addition, this bill more clearly defines the responsibilities of the agent to protect the interests of the principal, and it sets out guidelines for third-party acceptance. We support the passage and enactment of House Bill 254, Version U, and believe it will strengthen protection of vulnerable adults and older people in Alaska. To date, 13 states have enacted the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, with Hawaii and Iowa awaiting their governor's signature to become the 14th and 15th. Additionally, Connecticut and Kansas are considering it now. We encourage committee members to help include Alaska on this growing list. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this important legislation.
Well, thank you for joining us today, and please say hello for me the next time you see Pat Luby.
I will do that. He lives in Texas now.
Yeah, I heard he was moving. Any further questions? Anybody else signed up? With that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back for discussion. Anything that we should drag the sponsor up for? Seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move.
I'll remove my objection. Any further objections to adopting the SES?
No, if I could just discuss one point. I think this is a good bill. Page 3 refers to initial, and there's some concern about whether how that would operate consistent with sign, the definition on page 2, if somebody is truly incapacitated and they can't initial. But that can be dealt with downstream from here, and I don't think it's a reason to stop the bill.
Is there any further objection to adopting the CS? Seeing none, the adopted version of the CS is before us. Any further discussion on the CS? Seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute 254 version U from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Well, we're back on the record now, and the last item on the calendar today is House Bill 336, alcohol sales near churches and schools. We first heard the bill on March 26th. During that time, we heard a presentation on the bill and took loads of public testimony. Today, it's my intention to finish the public testimony and bring the bill back to the committee for action. With us to present the overview of the bill, sponsor Garen Carter, staff Samantha Weinstein. Who's going to do it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you want us to go over the bill
briefly.
Again, just briefly?
30,000.
Simple change from 200 to 400 feet, the buffer zone for alcohol sales near schools and churches.
That's not retroactive.
Not retroactive. That's very important. Thank you to get on the record and assure everyone it's only for, should this bill become law, for schools or churches, you know, in development at a future time.
Any questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, public testimony. Representative Perrin.
No.
Representative Chenault.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tarr, is there a number out there that we know how many of these are in that footage between 200 and 400 feet? Is there a list of existing facilities that are in that range?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, there is not. We discussed this at length with the department when we were first considering the legislation, and right now, because the requirement is the 200 feet, what they know is that nothing should be within 200 feet, but beyond that, nobody's been keeping track because it wasn't prohibited. Should this become law, then it would be prohibited, but up until now, because it hasn't been beyond 200 feet, they're not keeping track of those locations.
Could it be prohibited for new establishments?
Mm-hmm. For new. So any that fell within that would be grandfathered in. So if there was a school right now that was 300 feet, it wouldn't affect that because any existing business, school, church relationship, you know, within that proximity would not be affected.
A follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In future, let's say you have a church moves into a mall and that mall happens to have a liquor store or a bar in that mall, mm-hmm. How will this bill affect it?
Then it would be prohibited from being within 400 feet of the entrance to that. And the way they measure the entrance, there's different calculations. It's basically door-to-door entry. But, for example, for a school, it might include walking out the door, going to the sidewalk, crossing down the sidewalk, crossing over, and they would measure it that way. So they measure it in the way that's the most appropriate for how individuals would travel to and from those establishments.
And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, I guess my question would be, though, that if, let's say you have a new school, a charter school, for instance, because there would be one that you would have, mm-hmm. and they move into a neighborhood or they move into a strip mall, for instance, and they're within 400 feet of a bar or liquor store,
mm-hmm.
how would this affect the liquor store, or where would the onus be, I guess? Would the onus be on the school to go find another place that's more than 400 feet away, or would the onus become on the alcohol establishment because they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, maybe?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Chenault, the first example there where the charter school would need to pick a location that was outside of that 400 feet prohibition, so it wouldn't affect that existing business.
Mr. Representative Reinbold, followed by Representative Josephson.
I do think he brings up an important point, especially because we do have a lot of charter schools and churches, mm-hmm. in even when they're temporarily, like some of them temporarily meet in locations, churches, and I don't know if it would prohibit that church, you know, from meeting in that location for the alcohol. I didn't think about this, but before he brought that up, but I do think I'm sure it's addressable. But what my question was it's really important to know where you measure. Is it from the property line? Is it from door to door? Because technically 400 feet is not that much. I mean, it could mm-hmm. technically still be on the same school ground. So that's why I thought it was important, because I know when we build trails, I mean, by goodness, we want to know, is it from the easement line? Is it mm-hmm. from the door? Is it from, you know, the property line? I mean, we're incredibly careful. Sometimes we're battling over very small areas of non-disturbed mm-hmm.
vegetative easement. So anyway, just curious that you say it's door-to-door.
The way it reads right now, the premises would be located in a building having a public entrance within currently 200 feet. That would be changed to 400 feet of the boundary line of a school or a church building in which religious services are being regularly conducted. That was my
key point. If it's door-to-door, if it's driveway, because there's a huge difference between a door and an entrance to a school. And I was wondering if the entrance means the physical entrance or if the driveway entrance.
In discussing this with the department, my staff is going to help me out here, and if you want to add in, they explained it as the door-to-door. So that, for example, you're walking out of the school door, and the thing that makes this a little bit interesting in terms of how they do the calculations is it's not as the crow flies, so it's not the shortest distance between those two, but, for example, it'll include the sidewalk and the distance that the person traveling from one, the distance and way the person traveling from one establishment would get to the other. If that clears that up.
So enclosure door to door is that
okay. And let me just read this in here. What's in the bill is measured from the outer boundary line of the school or public entrance of the church building by the shortest pedestrian route to the nearest public entrance of the restaurant or eating place, and that's what the existing statute is. So that's how they've been doing these measurements, so this changes that distance.
Representative Joseph,
thank you. Representative Gark Tar. Could a school waive this this condition and say, look, this is the best location for us, we'll take the 300-foot location?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it's not the intent for there to be an opportunity to waive this. The intent is to extend the buffer for all future schools and churches.
So it would apply to both sides?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I confess I'm kind of concerned that this is a statewide solution to a local problem that was testified to rather eloquently by the students at the middle school. This legislation might put some additional distance between the schools and licensed premises, but I want to make sure it's not oversold, despite some of the statements in your sponsor statement, Representative, that talks about alcoholism and the costs and so forth. This bill does not address or fix alcoholism. It just puts the problem farther out of sight. And it could be argued that allowing children at school to see the effects of what alcohol abuse can do would be a disincentive to take up drinking. So there might be some benefit to having it close by. I'm glad to see this is only for future construction. It's not retroactive. And I would put in the record my intent and desire that they're not, at the future point, come back and try to say, well, now we have to move bars because we have established a 400-foot buffer that should be expanded. So, again, I don't want to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it does do some good. It does protect some kids. And on the basis of going forward for the future, I can accept it.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I appreciate those comments and the conversations that you and I have had about the bill, and it's important to not get ahead of ourselves about what the bill might do. So it is a hope that this is part of a bigger effort on the issues of alcoholism, although in practice what this bill will do will not address alcoholism, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Just as a comment, some of the larger churches in Anchorage have parking lots where you could go 400 feet before you would be out of their parking lot from the front mm-hmm. door. So it's, mm-hmm. I think 400 feet is probably a good compromise.
Mm-hmm. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had mentioned in that first hearing that in looking at this issue, we did look at what most other states were doing and found that ours at 200 feet was on the low end, that most were 300 or 400 or even 1,000, and people had a variety of ways they measured it. That is the little bit of the trick here of how people measure it. But that's why I felt like an appropriate thing to move forward on, that because we were on that lower end and looking at what other jurisdictions have done.
So centimeters and inches? Or
we haven't gotten there, but that could be a math lesson for the students, right?
Representative Reinbold, or?
Just one more question. Representative Tarr, has CHAR taken a position on this?
They have not taken a position through the chair, Representative Josephson. We've been in close contact with them. I didn't want this to be perceived as anti-business, and that was not my intent. I know they're responsible business owners, and we're all kind of trying to work on the same problems, not placing fault on anyone. And so we met with them when they were in town, let them know that I planned on introducing the legislation and where the idea came from. Since then, we've called them each step of the way to, you know, find out if there was an issue, and to date, no one has responded in that way. So
I would be guessing, but I think if you would have gone 500 feet or 1,000 feet, they probably would have had somebody testifying or a letter on file. Or, but then again, that's just I'm being probably a bit presumptive. But any further questions? Representative Heron? No. Anybody in the room care to testify? No. Anybody else online? Nobody online. With that, we'll close out public testimony.
I just have a quick question.
Well, you got both of them. Let's ask Smith one.
Have any church groups weighed in? I'm just curious. I mean, a lot of them are the ones running out in malls and stuff these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know we have instances in our community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just wanted to know if any church group or anybody has weighed in regards to this. I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
Well, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, because it's for future developments, we did check in again with some of the already established and discussed it, but because it doesn't impact them, it wasn't a concern. It's for, you know, future locations.
Paula?
Okay, I guess what my question, I'm just thinking of all the youth stuff we deal with, and they go and they meet here, they meet there. I mean, technically, mm-hmm. they're probably not a church, mm-hmm. even though it's a group of kids,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them go to the school. So I don't know if this impacts them in any way or not, because it's an organization,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure if church is defined. Probably, it may be defined.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, on line 14 and 15 on the first page, where it says, or a church building in which religious services are being regularly conducted. So I believe how it's enforced right now is just for the main building where the church services are conducted. It wouldn't apply to a facility where the youth ministry might meet or something like that.
Okay.
Any further questions?
Just
Representative Jones.
Thank you. So what about just restaurants that have beer and wine and nothing more? Would they be subject to this as well?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, for their future locations,
yeah,
in
yeah.
proximity to schools or churches, yes.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Representative Heron.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything, but it does. The conversation has brought up a question mark. We don't want liquor licenses to be within 400 feet of a school or a church. I get that. I support that. But when it's the other way around, so a school or a church was to go into a mall, does the law say that they've already had the liquor license already had a license, so it can be renewed even though the school or the church could be within 400 feet of them, mm-hmm. feet of it. So I guess there is a question mark.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would suggest if whatever the next committee is, there has to be an opinion clearing that up. What I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, what I'm
yeah.
saying is this a one-way street or is it a two-way street?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, I think I'm not clear on what your question is.
So, Mr. Chairman, the liquor license is there.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be within 400 feet. But what are if? I guess I'm having a hard time explaining
what if
my concern.
Goes under the mall after the liquor license has already been there. Is that
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Heron, my understanding is, you know, the liquor licensee wouldn't be their responsibility based on the distance, because they are again grandfathered in as an existing licensee, but it would be the responsibility of the church to find the location that is outside
yeah.
of the 400 feet.
The church cannot argue against it because they were the second one there.
Through the chair, yes, that's my understanding. Yeah. So it would be that would be a new location for the church, and as a result, they would need to follow the 400-foot buffer.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chairman, that's that is what is not, I mean, I guess we could talk it through and figure that out, but it doesn't state that in the proposed legislation. It only talks about the, in all intents and purposes, we're talking about the premise will be located in a building having a public entrance not closer than 400 feet, right? We're talking about the liquor license, not the school or the church, the way it's written. But, I mean, I appreciate the intent. Don't get me wrong.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, because that's what is written in existing statute, that's the way it's being enforced now. For us, the number is the main change, and then the part that states the grandfathered-in clause. So because that's how they're doing it right now, I'd imagine that's, you know, without talking with someone with Ledge Legal to walk that through, but that must have been at the time that the original statute was passed what seemed like the most appropriate way to put those boundaries.
The way I'm reading it is it's relocation of the liquor license to the church.
Exactly. But you go to page 2, line 12, section 2, line 12, and it's a restriction of location near churches and schools. Mm-hmm. But why isn't it also a restriction of location near liquor stores?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, this is in the alcohol section of statute, and so I think it's written because it's all of the things that apply to a liquor licensee, and so it's in that context, and then how then their relationship with churches or schools, rather than being, I think it would be in the other section of statute if it were to do it the other way. And
do we still have Shirley Cote online?
Yep.
That would have been too easy. We can probably get her. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have Shirley Cote from the Alcoholic Beverage Control online for questions. Representative Herron.
I forgot the question.
Don't make Shirley mad.
No. It's actually just a follow-up question from the speaker he asked earlier in the meeting is, so like the chairman says, chicken and egg. So now a church or a school has to consider being with outside of 400 feet from a liquor license?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, if a licensee is already in place on location and a church or a school wants to move in within currently the 200 feet, that's really up to the church or the school to do that. We don't have anything in place that would say a licensee has to move out of that location because they were there first, but like in all matters, the board of directors are the ones who make those kinds of decisions. And of course, when it comes time for renewal, you know, that can be considered at the time of renewal if there are objections or protests or something like that. So, you know, certainly there are mechanisms in place if there are issues or problems. But as it stands right now, if a church or school moves in within that that footage, we have not made the licensee shut down their business.
Shirley, can I get you to read yourself on the record, please?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. my name is Shirley Cote, and I'm director for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board.
And I don't know what kind of cell phone you have, but you're coming in better than people who have been dialing in from either offices or homes.
Oh, okay.
Representative Chenault, question?
And I guess just a follow-up. So even if we change this law to 400 feet, if the church chose to move within that 400 feet, that wouldn't affect the liquor license owner in any form or fashion until A year or two later, the church or the school decided that they didn't really like being that close to the liquor store, and so they got their people all fired up to come to the ABC board to try to get you to make the liquor license owner move. Is that something that, that might happen, could happen, or has happened?
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, that has not happened to my knowledge. That doesn't mean that it can't happen. Every other year when the licensee renews their license, any person, a local governing body can protest, but any person can object to the renewal of a license. So that is, certainly something that could happen, and the board would take it into consideration.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
Certainly.
So, you know, I just don't know exactly where I'm going with this other than, so you could have a large church move into an area that's within 400 feet or 200 feet currently, and at some future point in time create enough local pressure to cause that person who owned that store or owned the liquor license, for lack of better terms, that it's possible that the ABC board would force that liquor license holder to move their operations elsewhere.
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, that is a possibility that if there were issues or problems, that the church could come to the board and object to the renewal of that license. That is the case. That they could do that, and then the board would take it into consideration. We don't have a current situation or a past situation that I'm aware of where that has happened, but it certainly could happen. Yes, sir.
Certainly.
And Shirley, thank you. And just for a short follow-up, I have read in the Anchorage paper that there is a liquor store that's having problems with, and I don't know if that's a church group or a school or if it's just the community itself that would like to see a liquor store moved, curtail their hours, only sell to certain people. I can't remember all that's going on there. And I would assume that public testimony weighs pretty heavily on the ABC board's mind whenever they're trying to make those type of decisions. Which they should.
Through the chair, Representative Chenault, we've had situations before where a licensed premises would be well outside the 200 feet, but if there was an objection and the public outcry was such that that license was not approved.
Mm.
So it could happen whether it's 200 feet or 400 feet or 1,000 feet.
Right, right. And I agree, and thanks again, Shirley.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Representative Southler?
Thank you, Ms. Cote. And as I understand it, you're speaking of a church could raise issues that might play through the process of license renewal. And we're kind of talking about a statutory geographical limit. So you're saying that the church that moved into within 200 or envisioning this 400 feet of a licensed premise might get along fine for a while, but then when it came to renewal time might decide things weren't going fine. We're not going fine, and they would be able to protest the renewal of the license, but they couldn't object solely on grounds of proximity. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, that would be correct. And even with a new license application, a person could object at that time as well to any new license.
Okay, and there's nothing in the state statute other than the renewal provisions that would bar a church from moving into within 200 or 400 feet of a church now. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Basically, what I have, I was going to ask the staffer, but since you're on the phone, you may need to answer this question. But when I grew up, I used to shop at a place called University Center, and there was a lot of great stores in there. And now,
You know, there was a downturn many years ago in Orland, and the government kind of ended up buying out a lot of our malls. Like our Boniface Center is now the center of Anchorage School District and University Center. The UAA administrative offices are there, and it just seems like a lot of the old private sector places are now government buildings that we maintain and keep and house. And what my question is, like, let's say at the Anchorage School District headquarters, they decide to have Title I classes in or whatever, some new change, or the university, at the University Center, there's a restaurant, I believe, that serves alcohol, and also there's a liquor store, there used to be, in the liquor store and the Boniface Center, I don't know if they're there anymore, but is it, or what if they decide to put a preschool? I mean, do preschools count, especially if we're just getting ready to do preschool? I know Head Start has taken out a lot of our malls. I mean, there's Head Starts all over the state. I don't know if this impacts them or if they're technically a school or technically not a school.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, they are a school. The preschools are.
Okay.
They are considered a school under the definition of a school.
Okay, and then through the chair? So if, like, the administration at the Anchorage School District decides to have a new room there and they have classrooms or whatever in there, that could potentially be affected. Is it correct or not correct?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, if the licensed premises are already on location and the school or the church decides to move in, that's their decision to do that, and we don't have control over that. But if they do decide to move in, I think an issue before the board of directors maybe in the future is if there are issues with that particular license, and of course nobody wants, anybody with a license doesn't want to lose that license. So if there are issues, they're going to do everything that they can to make sure there are no issues. That's my experience with licensees. Mm-hmm. And so if there, you know, is an issue raised by the school, then that is something that the ABC board would hear, that they would listen to and make a decision regarding renewal.
Okay, because we're just about ready to go on to floor session right now, and we're going to potentially give tax credits to preschools and all that kind of stuff. And I just think it's important to address this issue and just make sure that we know who's impacted. Because, I mean, the concept, I think it's a good idea, and I think the intention is really, very good. And a lot of discussion happens in committee that you may not have foreseen. So I thank you for your input.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks again, Ms. Grippe.
Mr. Chairman, can
okay,
oh,
Chairman.
One more?
Yes, just to clarify, thank you. Ms. Grippe, it seems like the bill works all right in that if a church or school wants to move within the 400-foot range, they make that choice themselves, but they could not later say, hey, what are you doing here? You're within 400 proximity feet of us. They could raise some other grievance during the renewal phase that they sold to minors or they operated too late in violation of their license, that sort of thing. But they could raise the proximity argument because they created the proximity argument. Isn't that what you're saying?
Through the chair, I think this was Representative Josephson. Is that right?
Yes. Sorry.
Who is it?
You're correct. It's Representative Joseph.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I missed who asked the question, so I apologize. Yes, that they could raise that they could raise that issue, but first coming into the situation, you know, they make that conscious choice to move into that position, but then at any time, if there are issues, you know, oftentimes we get not often, but if we have a problem in an area with a licensee, we work with those licensees to correct that problem. So, yes, more often than not, they're going to try to fix whatever either the perception is or what the reality is. If there are complaints that underage persons are coming in, you know, we're going to, you know, take some action with that. We're going to, you know, probably do a compliance check on the place. But, you know, it takes a great deal to, for a license that is in operation, for that license to go away on a mere objection. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Well, thank you again, Shirley. Any further questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Any further questions for the bill sponsor, Samantha? Seeing none, it's back before the committee. What is the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 336 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any opposition to moving the bill out of committee? Seeing none, the bill moves out of committee, and we will adjourn at 5 minutes to 5.